The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Can you hear me? Anybody who has a cell phone, or would you turn it off, please? And there's no photography, no flash photography during this either. I'm Frank Wilson, the book editor of the Inquirer, and I promise, as I always do, that I won't be long. That's my gift. For my money, good prose is like a clear pane of glass. It's something that you look through, not at. And a good novel is one that lets you see the world straight up. Neat, no rocks, no mixer. The world as it happens to be, not as the novelist thinks it is or would like it to be. I also really don't care if the novelist tells me why the characters do what they do, because what I want to know is why the characters themselves think they're doing it. Which brings us to Elmore Leonard's novels, where the prose is sure to be 100 proof bottled and bond American, and is always served straight up, and where the scene is invariably this country, as it actually is, in all its gritty peculiarity, and especially as it sounds, which is important, because if you don't know a place, if you don't really know a place, if you can't catch the inflections of the people who are talking there. John Stuart Mill, of all people, said that the difference between eloquence and poetry is that eloquence is merely heard. Poetry is overheard. Given that when you read an Elmore Leonard novel, you feel like you're actually listening in on, overhearing, what the characters are saying to each other, I think it's fair to call them poetic. I also think it's fair to say that I should pipe down so that the man you came to hear can speak up. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Elmore Leonard.
Thank you. Wow. Well, I want to thank you all for that reception and also for coming. I've been places where no one came. But that was 50 years ago, so, because I've been doing this for 55 years now, I think. Originally, Up in Honey's Room was going to be called Hitler's Birthday. And my publisher said, Hitler's Birthday? You kidding? Hitler doesn't sell anymore. And we won't get the same, the orders that that we should get for this book. And I said, well, all right, I'll think of something else. So I thought of Up in Honey's Room. I don't know where it came from, but I thought it was good. But the girl in the book before was Helen. So then she became Honey if she's going to be on the cover. And Honey, I've been working on my women characters for a while now. Ever since the reviewer in the Detroit News said that my opinion of women, according to what she was reviewing, seemed to be on a par with Mickey Spillane. And I didn't agree, and yet I thought maybe I should work on the women a little more and, you know, make them important. Don't think of them as women. Think of the woman as a person. You know, and that's what I did. I would just pretend that I was the woman then and, you know, and recite her lines. So, I got to like Honey quite a bit. And I thought she should be, she should go after Carl Webster, who's been coming along now from, first in, what was he in? The book in 05. It's only 05. The hot kid. Thank you. As I get older, my talks become audience participation, helping me out. God, and I wrote the book and I couldn't think of the title. Anyway, then he was the main character in a serial that I wrote for the New York Times. And that was 14 parts, the end of, that was 05 too. And I had a little trouble getting my characters to talk for the New York Times, because being in that magazine rendered most of them mute, because they just couldn't come out with what they wanted to say. Because I did use, one person explains why these German POWs were escaping, and there were 350,000 German prisoners of war in the United States in the mid-40s. In 500 different camps. I had not heard one word about that. I was in the Navy. I was in the Pacific in 45, but I came home in 46 and didn't know anything about it. So to read that there were so many German POWs, and especially a bunch of them from the Africa Corps. The Africa Corps ran out of gas, and so they had to give up and were sent over here. They didn't feel that they were surrendering. They just ran out of gas, you know. If they had gas, they'd have continued on under Rommel. So I like the idea of then in the serial, The Hot Kid ends in 34, and then the serial ends in 45 with the escape of two of the POWs, and then Carl Webster has to go after him, and he knows they're going to be in Detroit, fortunately, because I live there, and it makes it easier for me. And yet, there was more research for this book than any other book I've written. 5 boxes of research. And because I had forgotten about gas rationing and food rationing, and of course, I had to get a book. I did have a book on the war itself. Every day of the war, from the time it started, from the time we entered the war until end of 45, or fall of 45, when the Japanese surrendered. So I had enough stuff. Then it's just, let's get it going. Let's bring Carl Webster to Detroit and see what happens. And so I had a good time writing it, because I wrote it the way I write every book, not knowing what's going to happen. I don't want to know what's going to happen. I like to sit down each day and wonder, now, where am I? What should come next? Because in the first 100 pages, I think nearly everybody, all the characters, will have been introduced. And they'll just start to move around a little bit. And then in the second 100 pages, maybe some more characters, some secondary characters come into play, and we find out who's who and who's opposed to who, whom. And and just get it going, you know. But I always write from a character's point of view, because I don't want to show myself, because I can't. I don't have the language to tell the story on my own. I'm not, say, Martin Amis, who has unlimited supply of words that he can use at any time. I'd ask Martin every once in a while, I'd say, why did you use that word? And he'd say, well, because it fit. It fit perfectly. And I said, do you ever look up in the dictionary words what they mean? And he said, well, you know, once in a while. And I was on Late Show, Charlie Rose. Charlie Rose, and Martin was too. He was waiting to come on next. And Charlie Rose said, what are you doing here with Martin Amis? I said, well, he asked me a lot of questions one time in Hollywood. he interviewed me, and I said, I should be interviewing him, but I wouldn't know what to ask, see? And he said, yeah, your styles are so different, Charlie said. I said, yes. I said, because I want to keep my nose out of the book. I want to just show rather than tell. But Martin has the language. He can tell. He can. He's a literary writer, and I'm not. He said, let's get Martin out here. So he came out, and Charlie said, did you hear what Elmore said about you? And Martin said, my heart soared like a hawk. And I said, to Charlie, see? And well, I have a good time writing. I really do. It's I don't have a good time writing screenplays. So in 93, I quit writing them. Because you have so many people to please, so many people. Just about everybody on the project seems to be have something to say about the screenplay and what they think should be in it. And but you write a book, I'm the only one I have to please, and I know that. I mean, once I have a publisher who likes me, then I know I can go ahead and write whatever I want, and that's the ideal situation. There was a movie that was finished based on one of mine not long ago, 310 to Yuma. And I wrote 310 to Yuma in 1953, 4,500-word short story. Dime Western paid me $90 for it, 2 cents a word. And Dime Western was one of the bigger payers. So then, about a year later, Columbia bought the screen rights for $4,000, which was more than I was making writing for an advertising agency, so it wasn't bad. But then Popular Publications, which owned Dime Western, took 25% because they had that right in the contract. So I ended up with $3,000 less the agent's commission. But the movie was good. I love the movie, and it holds up. It's still good. Then last year it was announced that Tom Cruise was going to appear in 310 to Yuma, and they sent me one of the scripts. I didn't read it, though, because I hate to read movie scripts. And after a while, he left. It was going to be an $80 million picture. Then Russell Crowe was hired to play the Glenn Ford part. Glenn Ford had originally turned it down because he thought he was going to be the good guy, not the stagecoach robber, so who was being hauled off to Yuma on the 310 by, who was it? Van Heflin, thank you. So now it's a $50 million picture. And my agent would call their production company every once in a while and say, wouldn't you like Elmore Leonard to be a consultant on it? No, they would not like it. I would have nothing to add, so they kept me out. However, another picture based on Killshot, I'm going to see next Tuesday when the director, John Madden, who did Shakespeare in Love, when he comes to show it to me, and he started out very, very close to the book and ran into some trouble with test audiences. His test audiences weren't sure what was going on in that movie, especially when everybody moved from the Detroit area to Cape Girardeau, Missouri. So what's going on now? And they thought a new story was developing. So John Madden had to do quite a lot of work and then reshot for about 3 weeks. And Harvey Weinstein is the production company, and Harvey, of course, helps cast. And he casts against what the character is in the book. There was a former prison guard, a woman, who she's retired because she used to have affairs with different convicts, and she was fired. And she had an affair with the one guy in the book, who was played by Joe Gordon-Levitt. Joe Gordon-Levitt was just in a picture called The Lookout, which was directed by Scott Frank. And Scott Frank has written two of mine. He wrote Get Shorty and Out of Sight with George Clooney. And I would have to wait until Scott read the book to find out what the theme is. So I'm never aware of theme, but he says it's very important. You got to know what the theme is in order to write the screenplay. I say, well, what's the theme of Get Shorty? He says it's about people who are older trying to make it in Hollywood. I said, wow. So, and I've forgotten what he said about Out of Sight. Maybe the same thing. Maybe as I get older too, it's older people trying to make it, you know. but I'm writing a book now. So anyway, up in Honey's room, finally was finished, and I was very pleased with it. It's what I wanted to write, and it's funny because then a critic will say, well, you know, it just doesn't move the way his stories normally move. And I thought, yeah, but it's 1945 is like a historical novel. You know, it's current to me, even though I had to look up a lot of stuff. But most of the readers weren't around in 45. And maybe they're not that interested in what was going on at that time, which I hadn't thought of. But still, I write what I want, and you can't do better than that. I mean, you can't have a better job than that, writing exactly what you want. So I don't write to order, and that's why I quit writing movies. So the last one I wrote was for William Friedkin. And Friedkin wanted me to rewrite a script that he was going to shoot. And I read the script and I said, I can't rewrite that. I don't think it's any good. And he said, well, just write what you want. Just write a movie because I want to use your dialogue. And I said, all right. So I had a situation where there was $3 million in a house in Florida that was going to be picked up, and it was dope money. It was going to be picked up sometime during the night and then sent on a trip around the world to be laundered. It's going to come back and it's all clean money. And he said, no, I don't want any laundering. I don't want any Colombians. I don't want any dope money. So I said, well, let me think about it a little bit. And my agent in Hollywood said, why don't you go home and write a book? What are you fooling around with this for? And I said, well, I'll give it 3 hours. That's all. So the next morning, I woke up at 5 o'clock. And I thought, well, I'll give it 3 hours. And I got the idea in about 5 minutes that this is money being made by a televangelist. And he's a healer. And he heals this little girl who stutters, and she can't say, praise Jesus. And he gets her to say it without stuttering. And everybody's sitting there, you know, the collection, and they're all putting their money in the collection. And he gets home, and the money's pouring in. He has people working there, opening envelopes and taking the money out. And part of it, he puts in an igloo cooler, and that's for him, for himself. Then I had to wait 3 hours, though, until 8 o'clock to call Bill Friedkin to tell him the idea. And he said, okay, write it. So I wrote it, but I really didn't have my heart in it. There was another time I went to, it's in North Africa. No. It's where they were shooting the man who would be king. Morocco, thanks. And they were shooting the man who would be king. And the producer of that picture wanted me to do something, write a screenplay for Sean Connery, Michael Caine, and Roger Moore. But, and two of them, of course, were in the man who would be king. And it took about a week for them to get around sitting in the lobby with me. And by that time, I had written a 50-page outline. And the producer, I forgot his name, he, and it really wouldn't matter if you came up with it, and he said, so I remember the first time in his office, I was in his office in Hollywood, and he had posters of all his movies on the walls. And he said, "You know who I am, don't you?" I said, "Yeah, you did, you know," and named some of the movies. And also, his partner was Paul Newman for a while. He was in one of mine. One time I approached a store in Beverly Hills. My wife and I, just as Paul Newman walked up, and I opened the door then he took the door and let my wife and me go in. And then, of course, we were scouting around to see what he was buying. You know, what? And my wife kept saying, "Go on up to him and tell him that you wrote Hombre." And I said, "I don't know if he liked it or not, you know." So we watched him, he was buying a sweater for his niece's birthday, and he put on a jacket, and it was kind of a dumb-looking jacket. It was a big, long jacket. He said, "This doesn't look bad." Standing in front of the mirror, he said to the clerk, and, you know, he could have put anything on, at all, anything at all, and it would have looked great. But he wasn't looking for anything. He wasn't looking for any kind of compliments. He seemed to be a good guy, but I didn't talk to him. So I don't know if I would now. I probably would now. "Hey, Paul, how'd you like, because I'm doing one now. I'm writing a book that the character from Out of Sight, played by George Clooney, and I heard that George Clooney thinks that was one of his favorite parts, this escaped bank robber. Well, now at the end of that picture, he goes back to prison to do 30 years. So I didn't want him to escape again, because he escaped in the beginning of that picture. I had to get him out somehow, because I wanted him to, have no problems, just that he's on the outside now. And then I wanted him to meet Dawn Navarro, who was a woman in Riding the Rap. And I thought I could do a lot more with Dawn Navarro. She's a psychic, but I wasn't sure how psychic she was. I mean, if she was a real psychic or not. Although she did come up with some psychic things, she knew all the words. Because now in this one, Jack Foley says to her, and I'm calling it Foley's back. Foley says to her, "How young were you when you found out you had a psychic ability?" She says, "When you're Sagittarian and you're born with a grand, I forgot what it is, something in your natal chart, you know, what else can you do?" And so she sounds convincing that she maybe is psychic. But then, of course, he's committed perhaps 100 bank robberies. There's a guy who's out to get him, FBI agent who says he's committed at least 200. And he tells Jack Foley, he says, I'm going to be watching you. We're going to be watching you. And if we see you coming out of a bank, and you're going back in prison. So, but the bad guy I wanted is Kundo Ray from La Brava, written, 27 years ago, I think. And Kundo Ray was a Cuban who came to the United States on the boat lift from Mariel when Castro opened the prisons and let the fellas come to Miami on their vacation. And Kundo Ray, I really liked. He was a go-go dancer, and he did his go-go in a leopard skin jock strap, and he painted cat whiskers on his face, and he called himself the Cat Prince. And he would dance in gay bars and also women's night. And, in other clubs. And he did better in women's clubs. But then I thought, yeah, this is the guy I want. And then I thought, wait, is he still alive? So I didn't remember. So I went back toward the end of La Brava, and Joe La Brava shoots him 3 times right in the chest and walks out. But he didn't check to see if he was still alive. Hey! So the emergency guys pick him up. He spends 62 days in a coma in a hospital in Florida. And he comes out of the coma, but he keeps his eyes closed and just kind of waits around listening to voices to find out where he is and what's going on. And finally he hires another Cuban who's mopping the floor. He says, get me out of here and I'll make you rich. Which the guy gets him out, and then he shoots him, I think. We think he shot the guy. So then he goes out to L.A. and gets into coke and he gets into crack and cocaine, which was very big at that particular time. Makes a lot of money. Buys homes in Venice Beach, that now are selling for millions of dollars, little homes that are all pushed together, crowded. There'll be a street that's just a sidewalk with the homes facing on the sidewalk, and each one is worth at least $1 million. So he has made a lot of money, so that when he goes to prison and Don Navarro, who he's met, and he puts in one of his houses, and Jack Foley, who puts him in another one of his houses, then they get together, and she says, where do you think he keeps his money? Well, that's the book. I don't know where yet, because I've just started, and I haven't come to that. So I don't have to worry about it yet. As soon as I get home, I'll start to worry about it. But not worry, I'll start to, make it sound believable. And that's what I do. What else? Do you want to know who I read? I've written down some so that I won't stumble and have to ask you what's it like. The other night in New York, I said, his name's Pete. I got a couple of Petes before Pete Dexter. Pete Dexter, I think, is terrific. He wrote Paris Trout and then other great books since then. I like Ron Hansen. Ron Hansen wrote a book. A Woman's Name in Ecstasy. And he's a very good writer. Richard Price, I like. George Pelecanos, Evan Hunter, who died, about 2 years ago. Ed McBain, I think he wrote the best police procedurals. Donald Westlake, also as Richard Stark. And I like Richard Price, did I name him? Dennis Lehane, Jim Hall, who teaches English courses and uses my books, he said, in his courses. And I asked him how. And he said, well, the way one studies Gatsby or The Sun Also Rises. And I asked him, well, what do you say in analyzing my books? And he said, oh, patterns of imagery, psychological and thematic coherence. All the stuff of academia, he said. And I thought, well, I'm glad I don't take his course because, you know, I might get a C reading my book. So I'll tell you why I don't read. Here's another one. I'll tell you why I don't write screenplays anymore. And this was said by, this was in an article Raymond Chandler wrote for the Atlantic Monthly in 1945. He said that the 2 years in Hollywood left him bored with the industry. Making a picture should be a fascinating adventure, but it's not. It's an endless contention of tawdry egos in what is a showman's paradise. He said that the basic art of motion pictures is the screenplay. Without it, there is nothing. But the screenwriter is a salaried employee with no power or decision over what he's written and without being honored for it. But he says there are screenwriters in Hollywood making $2,000 a week who have never had an original idea in their lives and who could not make 2 cents a word, as I was doing, in the pulp market. Chandler called them a pretty dreary bunch of hacks. Too many people have too much to say about a writer's work. And that's probably the main reason that I quit doing that. It ceases to be his own, and after a while, he ceases to care about it. He has brief enthusiasms, but they're destroyed before they can flower. People who can't write tell you how to write. The wise screenwriter wears his second-best suit, artistically speaking, and doesn't take things too much to heart. He should have a touch of cynicism, but only a touch. The complete cynic is as useless to Hollywood as he is to himself. He should do the best he can without straining at it. He should be scrupulously honest about his work, but shouldn't expect scrupulous honesty in return. He won't get it. And when he's had enough, he should say goodbye with a smile, because for all he knows, he may want to go back, or he may have to go back, you know, to make some money. Because you can make money in Hollywood. But regardless, I'm not going to go back to Hollywood. I certainly wouldn't move there. I wouldn't live in New York either. I don't know how the traffic is here, but just traffic would discourage me from living on either coast. I'm anxious to get back to writing. It gives me more pleasure than anything, even though it's hard. I sit down in the morning, I'll just pick up one of my old books, it doesn't matter which one, and open it anywhere and just start reading. The way when I began writing in 1950-51, I graduated from college in 50, University of Detroit. I was reading Hemingway. Religiously, I was reading, and I would open up For Whom the Bell Tolls anywhere, because I was writing westerns, and my feeling was that For Whom the Bell Tolls was kind of a western, because there were horses and guns, you know, and all that, and it could have been a border story. So now I'll pick up a book and just read it, open it anywhere and start reading, and sometimes I'll start laughing. I'll bust out laughing because I'm surprised by this sentence that I didn't laugh at when I wrote it, but now, years later, I laugh at, which I think is a good sign that it's, you know, it stays fresh. And then I get to work and I try and maintain my sound, and that's the thing, that's to me the most important thing. My son, Peter, who's 55 years old, he's my oldest son. I have five kids, and he has a sister who's older, and a sister and two brothers who are younger. And I have 12 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren, And Peter was in New York, same time I was, to see his publisher. He made a two-book deal with St. Martin's. And he doesn't think he sounds like me, but he does. He says, well, we have the same attitude. I said, I know, and that's what makes us sound the same, yeah, but the writing is pretty much the same. But he's good. But he thought he was going to just write the book and then send it out, and because all of his friends loved it. They said, God, this is really a good book. This was his first book, and then I read it, and I said, well, who's the main character? He says, what do you mean, who's the main character? I said, who's the main character? And eight other publishers said, who's the main character? So he had written another book, however, while this one was floating around, and that one sold. So he's rewritten the first one, which will be part of the two-book deal, and now he's written a third one, which is set in Rome. He went to school in Rome for about 6 months or so and ended up in jail. He and a friend stole a taxi cab. It was just for fun, you know. This taxi cab was sitting there with the motor running. So they hopped in, and they were surrounded before they got, you know, a block. And then he calls me up from prison. What are you doing in prison? And he said, oh, you know. So I got somebody to help him, a lawyer with Ford, who, you know, was Ford International, and got him out right away. But he loved Rome, and he had a good feeling about it, was able to write the book. Because when he told me about the book, maybe 6 years ago, the idea, I said, if you don't write it, I will, if you'll let me, because it's a good idea. And but at that time, he was writing screenplays, because he just saw writing as a way to make money. Writing fiction is a way to make money only, and not something that he could immerse himself in and take great pleasure in doing. And that's what he's doing now. Now he can't. He wants to write all the time. I mean, he was out skiing. He was out in Aspen 3 weeks ago. He has his own ad agency. He and a partner, and they make a lot of money. But he doesn't like writing ads, which is the same thing happened to me in 1961. I left after writing Chevrolet ads for 7 years. And you had to write cute then. You couldn't say kids. You couldn't use kids. You could say young'uns in the station wagon ad. So he's tired of that. He's tired of, you know, writing cute. And wants to get out. And he told St. Martin's that they're going to have to pay more money the next time. So he's got that drive. I mean, he knows what he's doing. Here comes my relief. Who will... What? Yeah. Oh, any questions?
The way the questions will work is you put your hand up, I'll call on you. Please leave your hand up so we can get a microphone. We're recording this right in front here. Why don't you use mine? Folks with the mics, come on down.
Start us off. Any advice about writing dialogue?
Pardon me?
Any advice about writing dialogue?
Oh, well, what's in your head? What's in your head? What do you hear? You know, you must hear people talking. I don't know. There is no secret to writing dialogue. You hear it. You hear people saying things. Once in a while, you'll hear somebody say something that you think you should write down because it's so good. But if it's really good, you're going to remember it anyway. But listen to it. Don't make it too, the sentences too long when people are talking. Get it short.
In the green right here, second row.
Thanks. Have you ever considered writing songs?
I would love to be able to write a song. I would love to be able to, but not so much the words as the melody. Because I think, how can there be an original melody with all the songs that there are, you know? And I always think of, "You Are the Sunshine of My Life." I think of Stevie Wonder. That's a good, it's a good, the words are good, everything about it is good. And the songs that I like "Baby Ain't I Good to You." You know, that's a wonderful song. I've got it in the book. I put it in the book because I had thought of it while I was writing it. Yes, I would love to be able to write songs.
Another question? And back, the gentleman in the green on the right, on my right. Keep going, to your right.
A couple of years ago you were by and you said that Rosie O'Donnell had optioned Tishomingo Blues, I think. Any other books of yours that are in the works as films?
Who did you say, Rosie O'Donnell?
I thought that's who had optioned.
She's in the press for other reasons.
Kathy Bates?
There is. I don't think there is anything currently that's in the works. No, there isn't. There isn't. But we always have hopes because more than 30 of my 40 or 41 books have been either optioned or bought outright. So because they look like movies, you know, scenes and a lot of dialogue.
Gentleman in the rust colored shirt.
Do you ever miss writing any books set with police novels, police characters in them? Some of my favorite characters have been the police lieutenants and so forth that you created over the years. Raymond Cruz, for instance, one of your books.
Yeah, and I did Mr. Paradise. That was 2 books ago, you know, and that was kind of a procedural. Yeah, I can always go back to that, yeah. Because Detroit, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on there. And I go down to police headquarters and you start hearing stories. And it's fun.
Another question? In the second row right here. Please. Thanks.
Where would you say your writing career started? Grade school or kindergarten or?
Grade school. In the 5th grade, I wrote a play. It was a World War I play. Inspired by All Quiet on the Western Front. I'm pretty sure the movie, which came out in 1930, rather than the book, though I did read the book, because at the time it was serialized in the Detroit Times. So then I wrote a play, and the desks, the rows of desks, was no man's land. And somebody has to crawl out under the desk to rescue... The coward has to crawl out under the desk to rescue the hero. I switched it around. And this was a Catholic school, and the Mother Superior came in and sat at the desk, you know, the teacher's desk, and that was my audience. I had 2 nuns in the audience. And that was the only performance. And do I wish I had that now? I could sell it. My 10 rules are being published because my 10 rules are used often, mentioned a lot, and by respected writers who say these rules are good rules, you know, and they were sort of tongue in cheek when I wrote them, but I wrote them when I was given a speech one time, and I gave the rules, and then I stepped off the stage. And I just had a yellow sheet with the 10 rules. And the guy said, "Can I have that?" I said, "Yeah, here." And then the New York Times asked me if I would write a column for their Writers on Writing. I don't know if they still do it. So I redid the 10 rules and added to them, you know, saying that some people needn't follow my rules, but they ought to take a look at them anyway, you know.
Did the nuns like the play?
Yes, of course they liked the play. And there wasn't anything religious about it at all. You know, there was no chaplain in the...
Another question. Gentleman right here in the third row.
How does it feel being a slightly older author with a wider range of fans? I mean, you're one of the few authors who are sort of like in your 50s, 60s.
Would you raise your voice, please?
You're one of the few authors who are in your like 50s, 60s. I don't know how old you are. I'm sorry.
What do you say?
You're one of the few more distinguished gentlemen in age who have an audience that ranges in age, like has such a wide range in terms of your audience age group. Like, I know people who read your books who are in their 20s, and I know people who read your books who are in their 70s. Like, how do you account for that? Yeah, like, how does that feel? I don't know.
To have a wide range of readers? Nothing like it. It's great. Because my audience, I think my audience is very intelligent. First, they're smart. Well, I think anybody who continually reads my book, they get it. You have to get it. You know, sometimes you have to get it.
Folks, we have time for one more question. Right here on the aisle in the green.
Where do you start your books? Do you start with your characters, or do you start with the story? And what sort of advice did you give your son when he was getting started in that same area?
I always start with characters. They move the book. It comes out of them, how their attitudes, how they deal with one another. I'll start with a situation. For example, Tishomingo Blues. A high diver, guy who dives off the top of an 80-foot ladder. So I said to my researcher, see if you can find a high diver somewhere. So he did, down in Florida Panhandle. And we went down, and there were a crew, about four high divers, who were putting the ladder up. Then finally a guy came from New Orleans who was the ace, and he finished the top part. And then that night they all performed, and they did a lot of crazy dives from different levels, and then this guy went off the top. And I got to know them, and they were just young guys who liked to dive, you know, they had all dived at Acapulco. Dived? Yeah, I suppose dived. They dove at but then when I got him in the book, he sells his act to a casino in Mississippi, gambling casino. There are a lot of casinos around in that area. And he puts it up, and I thought, somebody's going to have to come in and provide story here, though, some kind of a situation, because all this guy does is dive, and then later on that night he'll go out and drink beer and pick up a girl. So that's maybe a chapter. You know? So I have the Dixie Mafia show up. And there's no really such thing as the Dixie Mafia, except that anybody who is into crime in the South is called member of the Dixie Mafia. So that was easy enough, just to gather some bad guys around them. Some more advice? My son didn't really want advice. He didn't want any help. He wanted to do it on his own. And I said, you're nuts. I said, you have me. If you don't use me, you're crazy. Because first of all, I got him an agent. My agent naturally, my agent isn't going to turn down my son, is he? But he might have been walking the streets looking for an agent. You know, they're hard to get. Because most people think, you get an agent, then you're all set. He'll sell it. Well, the agent will tell you how to write it. You know, you have to learn how to. I said to my agent back in 52, she died in 50. Later on in the 50s, she didn't make much money off of me at all. I said, why don't you critique my story before you send it out, and then we won't get so many rejections. And she said, you learn how to write and I'll sell it. So then she went into the hospital, which she didn't come out, but she sent the manuscript, my first non-Western, to H.N. Swanson in Hollywood, who was a character, he was a character, Swanee. And Swanee read the book and called me up and he said, "Kiddo, did you write this book?" I said, "Yes, I wrote the book. It's got my name on it." He said, "Well, kiddo, I'm going to make you rich." And he got 84 rejections in the next 3 months. But we both knew it was going to sell. And it did. And it sold to the movies. And it was one of the worst pictures. It was, at the time, Ryan O'Neal and Lee Taylor Young were in it. And at the time, I said, this has got to be about the second worst movie ever made. There must be one that's worse, you know. Well, then they remade it about 3 years ago. And that was and I knew what the worst one was. Made no sense. So,
folks, there's only one Elmore Leonard. Please join me in thanking him.
Thank you.
I'll take you out in just a second. I need to make an announcement, and then I'll take you out for the seminar.
Folks, we've got an unusual night tonight. We've got about 500 people upstairs waiting to come down for the next event. Elmore, I'm going to take you out the back. When you leave the auditorium, ladies and gentlemen, exit to your right, because we've got a couple of other lines that are going to be converging as you are exiting. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.